Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. As Americans were reeling from the attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941, four boxes, meticulously packaged and inventory, left Washington, D.C. on a train with two Secret Service agents, and they headed west. Inside, the founding documents of the United States of America, the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, and others, documents so precious, President Franklin Roosevelt wanted to guarantee their preservation in the event that Axis powers bombed Washington. Weymouth author Stephen Pulio describes the efforts to safeguard these documents in his latest book, American Treasures, and he joins us now. Stephen, welcome back.
Thanks, Magda. Great to be here.
It's great to have you. So, first of all, tell us about this train journey. How is it that the United States Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, ended up heading towards where? Fort Knox?
You are correct. So, sure, the United States was very concerned. Roosevelt, Librarian of Congress, Archibald MacLeish, very concerned about these documents being destroyed after Pearl Harbor and after the Germans declare war on the United States. So this is great effort to move the documents to a safer location. Fort Knox is chosen for the Declaration, for the Constitution, for the Gettysburg Address, and a few other precious documents. Mm. But that begins the largest and secret relocation of documents in American history, when about 5,000 boxes are moved to various inland locations over the next several months.
Wow. And so how do they do this? Because, I mean, some of the documents, the Constitution, Declaration, already centuries old.
Absolutely. They were very, very careful about first collecting these documents in the year prior, because there's a great feeling that the country is going to go to war, and then packaging them up and keeping them under lock and key, if you will, for that time when it would be necessary. So the train, as you note, leaves Union Station on December 26th, 1941, the day after America's Pearl Harbor Christmas, and rumbles out to Fort Knox. There's a little space left in the gold bullion depository for just these few precious documents. The rest of the documents are moved at night in secret in the succeeding months by truck to these various locations.
And I understand that they even had to make modifications for the containers that held the documents because they needed to be sure that they stayed dry and things like that?
Yeah, humidity was a big issue. The concern about insects sort of chewing at the documents were big issues. So these things had to be packaged up very, very carefully.
Yeah. Now, we should note that the potential destruction of these documents wasn't an insignificant concern. I mean, Pearl Harbor had happened, and over in Europe, even the Brits had been worried about some of their founding documents and earlier had sent the Magna Carta to the United States?
Yeah, it's what was going on in Europe is what really concerned Roosevelt and Archibald MacLeish. So the Brits lost thousands, hundreds of thousands of documents during the Battle of Britain. They were incinerated, most of them. The Germans were destroying millions of manuscripts, documents in Europe, most by Jewish writers, but also some that were not by Jewish writers. So there's this real worry on Roosevelt's part and MacLeish's part that these documents could be in danger and that that would be devastating to the psyche and the morale of the American people. Mm. And you're right about the Magna Carta. The British had sent it over for the 1939 New York World's Fair. And when war breaks out in Europe, they ask us to hold on to it for safekeeping. That is one of the documents that goes to Fort Knox.
But I understand that we didn't even tell the British that we were moving Magna Carta?
We told them we were moving it, but to a safe spot, not to where we were moving it. Yes.
Wow. Well, I want to know, so you mentioned this fellow MacLeish, and he's very central to this story. Tell us more about him. How did he end up at the Library of Congress?
Yeah, Archibald MacLeish was a poet and a writer. He had left his job as a lawyer to become a full-time writer and a full-time poet. He had written several articles in support of the New Deal, several anti-fascist articles, and Roosevelt really liked him and asked him if he would come on to be a Librarian of Congress. Lots of dispute among professional librarians.
Because there's nothing that said he would actually be qualified as a librarian.
Absolutely.
Right?
Never had any experience. But Roosevelt really twisted his arm. MacLeish said no twice to the president. The president finally convinced him to come on board. And this is one of the major projects that he undertakes.
Huh. Now, you wrote that he gave a speech at Faneuil Hall in November 1940 when he talked about I'll just read a little part of it, a little quote from it. in such a time as ours, when wars are made against the spirit and its works, the keeping of these records is itself a kind of warfare. The keepers, whether they so wish it or not, cannot be neutral.
Yeah, MacLeish was a real staunch anti-fascist, and he took umbrage at some of his fellow writers and artists and intellectuals who refused to take a stand against the Nazis. MacLeish just felt like they were shirking their responsibility by staying neutral and not speaking out against Hitler. And he was quite the opposite. It's one of the things that I think attracts him to Roosevelt in the first place. FDR knows war is coming, I think, or at least strongly suspects war is coming. And it's one of the things that bonds those two.
Interesting. Now, there's another Massachusetts connection to this story, a Secret Service agent who was born in Pittsfield, I believe.
Harry Neal is the lead Secret Service agent in this. He's the person who's responsible for taking these documents to Union Station, managing the whole transfer. And yes, he's born in Pittsfield, spends lots of his time in Massachusetts, and then finally gets transferred down to Washington, becomes one of the great Secret Service agents, a legendary Secret Service agent. But he is the man responsible for it and views this activity as one of the most important efforts in his entire career.
Wow. Now, he began, what, as a stenographer and then worked his way up to the Secret Service?
Begins as a stenographer. He's finally asked to go on a mission with the Secret Service agents when they raid a Brooklyn house. And he ends up reaching into a furnace to pull out a counterfeit plate to save it as evidence against these counterfeiters. He becomes the legendary, you know, rookie agent who then works his way up and becomes one of the deputy directors of the Secret Service.
Okay. Now, just to remind folks that they sent the documents to Fort Knox, which, of course, is legendary, supposedly, in its security. So ostensibly it makes sense. But there's also the risk of the journey. I mean, why was that the site they chose? Were there other options that they also looked at for safekeeping of these documents?
So MacLeish asks Secretary of the Treasury Henry Morgenthau, where can we put all of these documents, these 5,000 boxes, in Fort Knox? And Morgenthau says, no, we don't have the room. There's too much gold. There's too much gold bullion stored there. You can have about 60 cubic feet, which is about the size of a freezer. It's a very small amount. So he picks these very few documents, the most important documents. And then the rest of the documents kind of get triaged. Very, very important documents, utterly irreplaceable, essential to American democracy, things like the president's papers, Washington's diaries, the notes of the Constitutional Convention, the journals of the Continental Congress, all of those. And they're transferred, as I say, under guard by truck to university repositories, all of which they examine about 60 and finally choose three or four. They need to be close enough to D.C. for the Library of Congress staff to inspect them while they're hidden, but far enough away so that German bombers, for example, wouldn't be attracted to that area.
And when did they finally get returned to Washington?
They come back in September of 1944, so about 3 months after D-Day, if you can just put that in your chronological mind, when there's very little concern about an attack on the American mainland at that point. And so they do all come back. The military intelligence says it's okay to bring them back. There is one exception. Earlier, the previous year in April of 1943, at the dedication of the Jefferson Memorial, FDR orders the original copy of the Declaration put on display because he felt that would be a real morale boost to the American people. And it is on display for 1 week. And nobody knows where it came from, and nobody knows where it went back to Fort Knox until it comes out in 44. Yeah.
So all this makes me wonder, do we know what the safety procedures are around these documents today?
We don't. They are secret. The Librarian of Congress, David Ferriero, who was kind enough to blurb this book and be part of this project from the beginning, during my interview with him, I asked him that very question, and he said, no, it's a big part of the security plan, and one of the biggest part of the security plan is not talking about the security plan. So since 9/11, that's really, really become secret.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're living in the modern age where, of course, there are very detailed digital copies and scans of most, not all of these documents, but definitely the Constitution, the Declaration, the big named ones that are publicly available. We can look it up right now on the internet. So in terms of what they look like and the information on them, one would hope that no matter what happens, we'll have that information in perpetuity. So why do you think it continues, it stays important to preserve the original documents themselves?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And as you may know, 1 million people file through the National Archives Rotunda every year to see these documents. And I think there's a couple of reasons. Number one, people kind of recognize that we are a constitutional republic that can trace our founding back to a single document, the Declaration of Independence. That's one. And two, these documents are living documents today. I mean, the whole underpinning of our philosophy is in the Declaration, and the Constitution is with us every day. Every time you hear a newscaster say, you know, does Congress have enough votes to override a presidential veto? Who will control the Senate in the next election? You know, what will the Supreme Court say about the constitutionality of this law? You're talking about the United States Constitution. So I think people kind of get that feeling that these documents are precious. They are part of our heritage. I had a very perceptive editor say to me one time, America has no crown jewels, but if it did, it would be these documents. And I think people recognize that when they see it at the Rotunda.
Yeah, direct connection.
Absolutely.
With that history and all that it means. Well, Stephen Puglio is author of American Treasures, The Secret Efforts to Save the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Gettysburg Address. He'll be speaking about his book at the Boston Public Library on February 1st, I believe, right?
That's right.
We've got more information about that at our website, radioboston.org. Stephen, thank you so much for sharing this story, and thanks for coming in.
My pleasure, Megan. Thank you.